Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Pedagogy Matters podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to bring to the fore some key topics of conversation in relation to learning and teaching, to discuss and break down aspects of practice and provide snippets, advice and guidance as to how to integrate these into our daily practice. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Kelly Moat from JISC, where we'll be discussing inclusive practice accessibility within learning and teaching. Kelly, good morning, how are you?
Hello, I'm very good, thanks very much.
Fantastic, well thank you for joining us. You know, it's a topic that we're kind of really keen to unpick and explore and kind of really discuss further, and obviously you've got a wealth of experience with your time at JISC, so yeah, kind of really look forward to it. And I think to kick off, Kelly, it might be useful if you want to kind of share a little bit about your role, about what you do at JISC, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. So I work at JISC, which provides like digital services and support to all of UK further and higher education. And I'm a subject specialist, and there's a bunch of subject specialists at JISC with specialisms in different areas. And my specialism is accessibility and assistive technology. So I largely do things like provide advice and guidance to our members, which is just anybody that's working in a college or university across the UK. So lots of advice and guidance. We also facilitate communities as well to help people learn from each other and support one another. And we do training and things as well and policy work. So we do a bunch of stuff. But basically the sort of common thread running through all the work that I do is digital accessibility and inclusive practice and using technology and making the most of it.
No, great, thanks Kelly. I think that's a really interesting place to start, is to kind of really explore or unpick what is meant by the term accessibility using assistive technology or inclusive practice, because I think that the word accessibility might mean different things to different people. So I guess in your world and from your perspective, what does that kind of word or phrase mean to yourself?
Yeah, so when we're talking about accessibility, because I realise, it can cover lots of things, for instance, like building accessibility. Yep. But for us, because, just covers all things kind of digital, we're talking about digital accessibility. And we'll come on in a moment to the kind of legal requirements around that as well. But really what it means is that users, whether they're students or staff, can use digital content and access it without barriers. So it's really just about creating stuff sort of in the way it should be created. but sometimes people aren't aware of things they're doing that might be creating barriers. So it's about just creating stuff that is able to be used by everybody, whether they're using assistive technology or not, or whether they've got diverse user needs or disabilities. It also means that content will display consistently and properly across different platforms and on different devices. So we saw especially, during kind of lockdown periods in the UK, we realised just how many students were using their phones to access content. And the great thing with accessible content is that it displays well on mobiles and it interacts well. Because I think, a lot of us have had the experience of maybe, especially during, maybe semi-lifting of lockdowns or whatever, things like restaurant menus and stuff were like QR codes, and you'd go and then you would get this like weird kind of image or PDF that you'd have to kind of zoom in on, and it would all be, and that's what inaccessible content looks like on a mobile phone. Accessible stuff just displays well, and so there's loads of benefits to that, but what we're talking about is digital stuff, and primarily content that is accessed through a browser. Yep. That's the sort of rule of thumb is what we're talking about, things accessed through a browser.
No, I think that makes it kind of really simple. And okay, jot down some notes and forgive me, creating stuff that can be used by everybody. I know I mean the digital realm, but that's it, because I'm a big believer in no matter what topic we discuss, there's a lot of different views, descriptions, analysis, it's kind of whatever it means. I'm a big believer in keeping things really, really simple. So when we're talking through and we are framing digital accessibility, it's about creating content or learning or materials that can be used by everybody irrespective of platform. And I think it's a really pertinent issue, because right now, as we know, even now we're in a post-COVID world where colleagues, especially in college, are returned typically back on campus. That doesn't mean to say all the learning is back on campus face-to-face and paper. Mm. There's a lot more digital use, which is interesting. And I know you touched a little bit upon the legal requirements. So mm-hmm. I think it's useful if we go there first, then we'll kind of look broader and think, well, what does this actually all mean in practice to me and my role and so on and so forth? Mm-hmm. So over to you for the legal bit.
Okay, so, yeah, this no is pressure. The legal bit. Yeah. So, obviously, like I mentioned, creating content that's accessible is doing it the right way. And there's also, as you mentioned as well, there's real, kind of ethical and practical benefits to that. But there is a legal imperative now as well. So the public sector bodies, website and mobile applications, accessibility regulations, as I said, it's abbreviated to PSBAR or just accessibility regulations. And were introduced in 2018. Yeah, 2018, coming in sort of as part of a European directive at that time, but it's now UK law, and it's non-devolved, so it covers all of the UK equally, and it is monitored by a part of the Cabinet Office called the Central Data and Digital Office. So what the accessibility regulations say is that if you're a public sector body, which virtually all colleges will be, unless they're kind of private colleges, they need to be producing digital content that meets a certain defined standard. And that is a standard that means the content meets accessibility requirements. So that standard is known as WCAG 2.1AA, and WCAG is an abbreviation of the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. So this is a legal requirement that will be affecting all our colleges. So you need to have, kind of plans in place to improve your content, to ensure new content meets these standards. In terms of how the law is implemented, across the public sector, there's kind of two strands to it. One is there's the monitoring, and that is kind of checking that people are doing what they need to be doing. So websites or digital content is selected kind of at random by the Central Digital and Data Office for monitoring. So they will test your content. And we know that this year, in the last 12 months, further education colleges have seen a kind of increase in their content being monitored. You'll know that you've been monitored because you receive an email or a letter from the Cabinet Office that tells you you've been monitored, and it tells you where your content has problems, and you have 12 weeks to remediate your content and come up with a plan. So that's the monitoring. You can also be monitored as a result of a direct complaint being made about your content, and basically anyone can do that, and that can be a visitor, a student, or a member of staff. And this isn't just websites. It's often, sometimes people think it's just websites. It's basically everything accessed through a browser, and that includes third-party content that you've paid for, so software and systems. You become responsible for them at the point that you pay for them. So that's the monitoring. But then there's the other bit that people are kind of interested in, is the enforcement. So what actually happens if it all goes pear-shaped? So if your response is not quite satisfactory to the monitoring or the complaint, then the evidence will be passed to the Equality and Human Rights Commission, who can then take legal action using the Equality Act. And because the Equality Act, when legal action is taken using that, there's kind of confidentiality agreements. So that means when people say, well, what actually happened? It's like, well, I don't know. Only the people who were involved know what happens. But it is, it's a proper law. It's very similar in terms of how it came into GDPR. Yeah. Except the thing with GDPR is that the fines were very explicit and sort of focused the mind somewhat. But we don't know what the penalties are for non-compliance with accessibility regulations, but we do know that you don't want to get to that point. So it needs to be taken kind of seriously. So the requirements are that your content meets a certain standard, but there's also another thing as well, which is that you must have on your website an accessibility statement, and that needs to follow government wording, and it needs to state what you're doing to make your site more accessible. It needs to be transparent about any problems that you do have and what you're going to do to fix them. And also, very importantly as well, it needs to have a contact name and details for anybody that has that's experiencing difficulties. And that's really important. That's the sort of thing that CDDO look for. But it's also really important in terms of dealing with problems before they get escalated as well. It's better if someone comes to you and tells you they're having difficulty and you fix that rather than they make a complaint about you. So it's all about kind of transparency and open communication about what you're doing and where you've got problems.
No, great. Well, Kelly, I think you've done that very clearly, because I think it's a very complex area, the kind of legal requirements. It makes total sense. And I think for our colleagues who are listening, I think it's useful to kind of provide that context. So we have a mixture of people who will be senior management and kind of responsible for, we'll say, parts of the website and kind of external facing comments, but also quite a few lecturers who will be listening in terms of think, well, what does this mean to me? Mm. Which I know is kind of what we're going to move into now in terms of, and what I will say is, I'm no expert in this space whatsoever, but what I have noticed is, again, since the COVID time and through Office 365 and other platforms, there are a whole host of different things. I'm going to say things because that's a word I used to kind of mention lots of different things, but there are a whole host of different tools out there which can be used and kind of really embraced. And I'm sure there's different aspects of AI you might mention now. So I guess the key bit now is, so I'm a practitioner. Mm-hmm. How do I do it? What tools are out there to kind of help me, to support me, to help me develop this? So what are your thoughts around that?
Yeah.
Where do we start?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, when you first approach accessibility, it can look like a very technical and large area. But I think the thing to bear in mind is that especially for lecturing staff, there's a whole raft of stuff that actually they don't need to concern themselves with, that is the remit of web developers and designers and content creators and things. It's a lot of the stuff is not stuff for them to worry about. So the best thing to do is to focus on, well, what does impact lecturers and what can you do? And actually it's quite a sort of focused area. So if you are creating, for instance, documents or PowerPoints, those need to be accessible because in all likelihood they'll be uploaded to your virtual learning environment, and that obviously comes under scope of things accessed through a browser. So the great thing is, as you mentioned, there's an increase you'll notice in 365 and other platforms as well, to providing tools to help you to do this. So both Word and PowerPoint have got inbuilt accessibility checkers. And they will kind of go through your document and flag where there's issues. A cool thing with that is that when you've done that a few times, you actually start to see, okay, actually, if I just did things in a certain way the first time, I don't have to go back and fix them. Yeah. And it can be very simple. It's really, again, it's about constructing things in the correct way. So, for instance, in a Word document, having like an actual heading, attributing the text with a heading style rather than just making text bigger and bold. That helps lots of people who are accessing using assistive technology, but it also means when things are opened on different devices, it'll display consistently. And similarly with PowerPoint as well, when you run the PowerPoint accessibility checker, it'll do things like ask you where there's an image, is this image just decorative? Sometimes it is just decorative, you've got something to look nice, or is it conveying information? And where it's conveying information, you need to pop in a little descriptor. And that's known as alternative text or alt text. So there's lots of things in place to support you when you're creating your own content to make sure it's accessible. And again, we provide, and I'll point to this in a moment, lots of guidance on how to do this. Obviously, it gets a bit more a bit more complex when you get into subjects that are more like kind of STEM subjects, where your diagrams and images may be containing more complex information that needs to be described in a certain way. And again, that's the sort of thing, like at JISC and within our communities, we've got dedicated groups who support one another with doing that. And you know, direct people to resources that, that will help with that. So, so Word and PowerPoint are a really good place to start. And then the other thing to think about is the tools that you're using as well. You know, if you're using, for instance, online collaboration tools, you need to make sure that everyone's going to be able to use those. A quick way to find out is to just Google like the name of the tool and the word accessibility to see if they've got an accessibility statement. And again, with third party tools as well, is although your college is actually assumes the responsibility for tools being inaccessible if they've been paid for, what we can do is push back onto suppliers and ask them to provide accessibility information, and also to tell them, like, we need to be procuring stuff that is accessible. And so start to embed it in your procurement as well, to sort of start pushing back that responsibility onto the developers and suppliers, and inform your decisions. So those are a couple of things that, that can be done. In terms of a big one we get asked about a lot is, and especially since, you know, sort of 2020, is what to do about video. So there's a number of ways to make video accessible, but the one that most people are sort of focused on is captioning. So there's a lot of, you mentioned kind of AI, and the AI underpinning automatic captioning is getting better all the time. In some cases, it is comparable to human captioning in terms of humans will make mistakes as well as AI. You know, it's kind of, it's on a level there, but there can be discrepancies depending on sometimes like accent or the way that people speak, because it is basically, it's just machine learning. It will work with what it's most familiar with. So it is getting better, but what we do appreciate that checking and correcting captioning on video is very time consuming, but that's just to explain why that's necessary. So with video, the kind of legal requirement is that automatic captioning isn't actually enough in itself. Captions have to be checked and corrected. Automatic captioning can be very decent, and sometimes we've had, you know, we've made videos where the automatic captioning is almost kind of flawless. But we do recognise that sometimes that won't be the case. It can be really time consuming, but for instance, one of the things that JISC does is there's an arm of JISC known as CHEST, which negotiates like licensing agreements on behalf of the sector. It's non-profit, it's supplier agnostic, but it exists to basically save the sector money. And one of the agreements they've got at the moment is for, I think, a tool called Verbit, which is a caption correction service. And like, I use that myself. I take advantage of that. And it turns basically like a 6-hour job into a 10-minute job. So, you know, there are tools out there as well and services that you can use as well.
No, I think that's really interesting. And the points you mentioned there are really, I'm going to say key, but also quite simple to use. So just jumping back to what you said in terms of kind of Word and PowerPoint in terms of digital accessibility checker, I totally agree. It's a way of really training yourself to be aware of kind of which of the cues that often pop up. And for those that haven't seen, if you click on Word itself, if you click on review at the top and then check accessibility along the top bar, it'll give you a review and a rating and some pointers as to what to consider. And you're absolutely right in terms of headings and titles. It trains you to use the titles within Word, therefore make it more accessible, which is, yeah, it's really quite simple. And on the video point in terms of captions, I'm sure I saw some research the other day about the amount of young people watching Netflix with the subtitles on, with the captions on. I mean, I don't know why, but I do that now as well, not because of my age, I hope, but purely it becomes second nature to watch it whilst kind of watching a video there. So I think the more digital content that we have as education providers, it's essential that it is accessible for exactly those reasons that you've mentioned there as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, another way of dealing with video as well is also thinking about, you know, the amount of video that you do need to upload. Because I think there was a bit of a thing, you know, when we were all using Teams and Zoom, and it was so easy to record and pop it onto YouTube or whatever. I think, you know, like my sort of personal take is that maybe too much video was getting uploaded. And it's not just from an you know, from the point of view of, well, the, you know, the amount of time it takes to correct captions, there's also there's a lot of value in curating your video content as well. Because for a start, it's, you know, there's a digital carbon footprint to uploading video. So it's kind of like, I always think of it as sort of digital landfill. It's like, if you're uploading video that's not being watched, you know, that's like occupying space on a server. It's generating energy. So we shouldn't be, you know, doing that. There's also, you know, sometimes a risk as well in putting up content that then goes out of date. You know, you should be taking content down as soon as it goes out of date, usually sort of 12 months. And there's data protection issues as well. If different people are speaking in a video, you know, like videos of discussions and meetings and things, probably it's not necessarily a good idea to share them. So the thing is, if you kind of take that approach of curating your video to making it, you know, more quality and more impactful, cut down the amount, then it makes the whole thing like captioning and providing transcripts is a bit easier because you've got like less content to deal with. It's just a bit more streamlined.
Absolutely. And also from a student's perspective, you know, I was a big believer in, again, over especially lockdown period, I use the term a lot of noise. There was a lot of noise out there because you're absolutely right. There's so many videos out there. Mm. You don't know where to start. And again, when working with our learners and our student population, it's really important to signpost them to appropriate videos that may or may not be relevant to them. Yes, there's an activity in there around students self-regulating that themselves and identifying what's useful and relevant to them. But no, you're absolutely right in terms of the quality of video content. I've noticed it significantly improved over the last 2 to 3 years. But there's a lot of work to be done there in that space there as well, and making sure that video content is accessible there as well. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So I guess, conscious that kind of time is racing away from us, what I'm keen to kind of unpick is, what are the key principles to consider? We've touched upon one or two there in terms of creating them and kind of making them relevant. Are there any other principles to consider or key measures to consider when using tools around accessibility?
I think, well, if we go in terms of principles, if we go to like very kind of high level, of sort of strategic level, is that accessibility involves lots of different people across a college. So although we're thinking about, you know, perhaps the practitioner perspective here, there's a lot of other folks involved. Absolutely. And it requires a lot of join up. You know, you're talking about folks because you mentioned responsibility earlier, and there's like accountability as well. It's like, whose desk is that letter going to land on when there's an issue? It's not going to be a lecturer's desk. It's going to be someone in senior management that's going to be held accountable. But it is everybody in the organisation is responsible. But you've also got people like, you know, your VLE managers, library folks, procurement. You know, we've got all these different people that need to be involved. So I'd say one of the key principles is working together and creating a shared vision and plan for how you're going to do it. Because again, with among staff, there's going to be some people who are more confident about using accessibility checkers or, you know, etc., and some who it might be completely new to them, and they might not really understand why it's important, because they might look at their stuff and think, well, it looks okay, but not realize like that actually it's going to present barriers to folks. So what I'd say is the kind of ultimate thing to crack is getting some senior management buy-in, because that's when it becomes a priority. Like one of my colleagues often says, who works in kind of strategy, it's like, if this isn't important to the people in leadership, why should it be important to me? Yeah. You know, so it needs that leadership ownership. And then at that point as well, then you get, you know, you're more likely to get time and resources released for it. So what we do at JISC with colleges, and you know, we don't charge for this, we offer a workshop to people working in colleges called Vision for Accessibility, and a large part of that is actually getting all the key people together. You know, it's done, we say around the table, but it's around the Teams room because it's online. But it's to make sure everybody's actually got a shared vision, and you know, where they can actually support each other and create a roadmap. So I would say that's the number one thing, is a joined up approach with leadership buy-in is absolutely key. I think that's where the colleges that do this well, that's what they're doing. Otherwise, you'll get like little pockets of good practice. and in other areas that are just completely neglected. So that's absolutely key. I think the other thing is, like you were, you know, sort of keen to emphasize as well, is that we have tools at our fingertips that we don't have to pay for that can support us. So you've got the inbuilt tools in Microsoft Office. There's also lots of other free ones as well. We direct people to lots of free stuff and approaches in a guide. We do lots of online guidance, but probably our best starting point is if you just Google for practical steps to meeting accessibility regulations from JISC, and that gives you lots of links to free checkers and things that will help you generate your statement and things like that as well. And the third principle I would say as well is beyond your college is the best way to find out how to do something is talking to people who've already done it. So that's absolutely why we facilitate, we do loads of community stuff. We've got an absolutely massive community in Teams. I think at the moment it's got 1,400 users on there with about, I don't know, I've got about 20 channels at least of like for different subjects. You know, we've got channels for all sorts of different things. We also do online drop-in clinics, got mailing lists as well, if that's something you prefer. We've got ideas rooms, which are done in Zoom, where people just come along and chat. And we're also, for this year, we're developing buddying as an approach, like between organisations, to help, you know, that to facilitate that peer-to-peer support and learning and co-production as well. So I would say, you know, my kind of third big principle is just get stuck in. The accessibility and assistive technology communities are really friendly, really generous with their knowledge. And it's like, if you know nothing, you're just as welcome as someone who's like a tip-top expert. And we do loads of stuff around that, and it doesn't cost anything. Like all the things I've been talking about today that comes from, you know, provided by JISC, it doesn't cost you anything. It's all inclusive of your JISC membership.
No, and I think that's a really good point to kind of share, because it's a lot of people will be aware of JISC, but they won't know what they do or how they can benefit individuals in their roles. And as you rightly mentioned, it's not just practitioners, there's a whole host of different roles across the college sector that can need to be mindful of this. No, I think that's really important. So yeah, I would implore listeners to do that, to firstly kind of have a look at the JISC website and understand a bit more about kind of what's available and what's on offer. But no, and then secondly, totally agree, talk to people, learn, share, magpie from each other, collaborate, and on all those different aspects there, because it's a common challenge, it's a common problem that we can all need to kind of learn from each other and kind of work individually, but also work collaboratively to kind of to address accessibility issues and try and help make whether that puts you on, whether that be a website, whether that be a learning experience, as accessible as possible. But Kelly, thank you very much for your time. And we've just got magic to complete that within time then. I think we're finished on a really positive note, in the sense of there's a load of tools out there to kind of go and look at. And again, I'll just kind of repeat really what you've said, in the sense of the starting point for you, if you're kind of really keen, is to Google JISC practical steps to meeting accessibility. Because I've done that, found the website, and there's lots of information there. But also your details are on there to kind of get in touch with, and you and your colleagues and support listeners. So Kelly, fantastic. Thank you for your time. And I look forward to catching up again in the near future.
Okay, thanks very much. That was fun.